You're tuned in to Positively Terrible. I'm producer Dan, and each week my buddy Scott and I discuss surviving and thriving after trauma. It's a journey that started when Scott, his wife's fiance, and her boyfriend walked into a bar. This week's decent human being is Katrina. She's got a fucked up story about all kinds of shit. Settle in, my terrible listeners. Today's episode is going to be positively terrible. Hey, Scott.
Dan, what's going on, man? How are you?
Dude, I'm doing well today. Thank you. Yeah? Thank you for asking.
How's the dental work holding up?
It's all still there. My teeth have not fallen out since we last talked, which I'm happy about. But I got something else good to tell you.
Oh, okay.
My truck, it's 2008, has been squeaking for 2 years. It has been in the shop for said squeak six times, and it always came back. And this week I changed a brake caliper and it seems the squeak is gone. I drove around in the truck all day and it was a joy. I've wanted to not be in it for a long time. And without the squeak, it was super fun to be in. So my day is good.
Well, I know about 6 months ago, I pulled up to your alley and your car, your truck was in the alley with no wheels on it, or at least the front wheels were off because you're trying to do. Was that the same issue? Or was that something else?
Searching. That was part of it. We're changing all kinds of parts.
Okay. All right. Well, congratulations, Dan. Thank you. We will do a show about the trauma of the squeak. And I think that's actually the name we'll use, the trauma of the squeak, with producer Dan.
Totally appropriate.
But okay, well, good job, producer Dan. I'm so happy for you. I'm humbled you shared with us. Thank you so much. Katrina's here, though. And Katrina, how are your brakes?
My brakes are fabulous and not squeaking, so I'm good.
All right. Okay.
Good answer.
And did you have to do anything? Did you have to take your wheels off, or did they just not squeak?
I let my husband handle all of that. Oh, so as soon as I hear a noise, like, I'm on it with him. But of course, you know, the noise goes away when I'm trying to point it out to him. So,
oh yeah, for sure. I just got a brake job a couple of weeks ago. And when I took it into the shop to have them do it, because I am not fixing my car in the alley, nor would I know how to fix my car in the alley. I took it to the shop and it absolutely was not squeak. My brakes weren't squeaking. And I drove it around. I'm like, it's been every time for a month that I drove that it was. And then I took it in and they're like, well, there's nothing squeaking. And I'm, okay, well, take a look. And of course, even if they didn't find anything, I'm sure they would have certainly found a way to charge me for them. But I've got some really nice new brakes myself. I'm glad we all have some good stopping capabilities. That makes me happy. That's a good way to start a Saturday. But Katrina, okay, I'm going to stop this silly part of the show. Dan gave you a rather broad introduction today. Can you take a second to, I'm just going to ask you for like the couple sentences summary of why you're here today.
So I am a sober mom for the last 13, coming up on 14 years. And 7 years into my sobriety, I found myself in what I call a spiritual crisis with a rope around my neck. And I've overcome codependency through all of that as well. But that is like the main reason. And we'll definitely dive more into that, I know, through the story. So,
and that's not a metaphorical rope around your neck.
No, it's not. That's not
people dragging you down.
No, it's not a met. It's a, I found myself in my bedroom with a rope around my neck and thought, I wonder what this is going to feel like. I wonder what this is going to do. And it wasn't necessarily an intention to, even though I've always had suicidal thoughts throughout my entire life, it's something I've dealt with, but there was a, I wonder if more than a, okay, let this take me out. And it was an interesting point where I just felt really low in my life and I had a lot of great things going on for me, but I found myself in that on the in my closet with this rope I found from our garage, put it around my neck, sat and put, you know, pushed forward as far as I could, stood up and I was like, huh, I wonder, huh, let's do that again. And I think I did it like three more times, just seeing how far I could push myself, probably for a desire to feel something more than anything than what I was feeling. How far could I go? And as soon as I got up, I hid the rope in a boot for some reason. And I was clearly not really in my right mind, even though it seemed like it. I called my husband and told him what I did. And he was just like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah. And then I went and sat up down on the couch and watched TV like nothing had happened.
Wow. That is intense. But I want to back up. So let's go back when you and I talked the first time. I think you described yourself as a good girl growing up, didn't drink until 21. So can we kind of go back to your maybe teenage years? Who was Katrina back then?
Yeah, absolutely. In my teenage years, I was the adult of my household. Okay. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My parents had divorced and separated when I was 14 years old. My dad walked out on our family the day after Christmas, and he had another family. He had another woman that he was with who had kids. And that turned me into the adult of the house. My brother had turned to drugs. My mom drank even more, and there was fights. And so my teenage years were very rough. I was abandoned by my own dad. I was trying to take care of my brother. I was trying to take care of my mom, which was always in my nature anyways from a kid. I was always that kid that liked hanging out with the adults. Whenever my parents would go out to their friend's house every Friday night, they'd spend Friday nights drinking and hang, you know, listening to music. I'd always want to go hang out with them. I had a hard time making friends for some reason or recognizing the friends that I had. But I was also a girl who just had a huge heart, always have, who had these big ideas and big dreams, but lost herself in other people. And I loved to sing. I loved to dance. I was never really that great at it, but I loved it. I'm still not that great at it, and I love it. But I lost myself in my teenage years because I was so worried about other people. And I found myself in a relationship with my first boyfriend at the age of 15. And I've always been in a relationship since. I've skipped from relationship to relationship since then, you know, trying to fill those holes that were left by my parents, the love and acknowledgement from my parents.
Okay. So it sounds like you said, you took care of a sibling, take care of people around you. Was that part of your identity? Was like kind of the caretaker?
Unbeknownst to me, really, kind of being forced into that. Mm-hmm. And I did it with, as I grew older, I did it with resentment. But there was that deep seated, just like, I have to do this because if I disappoint, especially my mom, because my dad was out of the picture for several years, I didn't talk to him because she was that scorned woman who, you know, played my brother and I against my dad. And so, yeah, it was like something I was thrown into. And it was just like this unconscious thing that I did that I didn't want to do, but I didn't know how to do anything differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense. I think I've seen that quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
And you are sober now. And I don't think you said, I'm not sure, maybe you did say the word, like, do you consider, is that because you were an alcoholic?
Yeah, I was an alcoholic. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. And
let me interject here real quick.
Yeah.
Katrina, I am enjoying some non-alcoholic beer right now as we converse. Is that a problem? I'm happy to go get something else.
No, absolutely okay. Not. I have no issues. You do you. Like, it doesn't bother me whatsoever. And no judgment from me. Like, people, it's my life, not yours.
Totally. Well, I'd rather have Scott be the thing that triggers you rather than this beverage.
Yeah, no, continue, you're Scott. Yeah, I appreciate the acknowledgement, and no, you're good.
Yeah, Dan can put down a lot of non-alcoholic beers. I don't get it. I have no interest. I don't have a lot of interest in the alcoholic beers either, but we go watch football, and I think Dan might have, I can almost guarantee Dan has required this bar to order more than their normal stock than they used to.
Yeah, and their stock sucks. I wish that they would get a better non-alcoholic beer. But
well, since you're the only person that drinks it, can't you just ask them?
I don't think they were sober when I asked.
Okay, all right. So Katrina, you didn't drink until you were of legal age, is what you told me, I believe, in our first meeting together. So were you intentionally, like, did you recognize alcoholism and, like, not want to fall into that? Is that why you didn't drink, like, in your teenage years, like a lot of people do?
Yeah, I will back up and I will correct myself. I did start to drink when I was, like, 19, a little bit. I had marijuana was my preferred substance.
Got it. Okay.
And I got kind of pressured into that. I was dating somebody who was in a band, and like that was the crowd we were hanging out in. And so that is where the addiction actually started, was with marijuana.
Okay.
And I was a good girl. Like, I still considered myself a good girl. Like, it was hard for me to like go into this space. And then, but 19, and I was like, nah, it's not my thing. But for some reason I was more okay with this other thing. And then 20, as soon as I hit 21, like I could go to the bars, things just clicked and took off. Like, oh, it's okay now. Because I always carried a lot of guilt when I did drink, or even when I did smoke weed. Like I did carry that guilt. Like, sure, this is not okay. But yeah, when I was 21 is like when things started to take off, and it was all downhill from there.
Got it. And you said that you might have misspoke. I probably took the note down wrong. So just like Dan said, it's blame Scott. We like to do that around here. Yeah, I get that. And like, I didn't drink through high school. I did drink a little bit starting when I was 18, and then I got to college and I wasn't legal yet, but that's when I started drinking heavily. But when the doors opened, they opened.
Yeah.
Right.
And okay. I didn't answer your question. I realized I didn't really recognize alcoholism until later. I didn't know that it was really such a thing, even though it's prevalent in both sides of my family.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was like, oh, there was this thing and it's a problem. There's actually help, and like people go through this.
Right. Was it just normal to you? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it was just normal. It was just like what people do.
Okay. And then when you started drinking and the floodgates open, were you still smoking weed, marijuana at that time too?
Yes, I was. And I started to lay more off the weed because at the time I started to separate from the boyfriend I was with.
Okay.
And so this is where like that chameleon aspect that I like to say comes in, when we like, you know, change ourselves to fit in with the group that we're fitting in with and that we're hanging with. And so I got away from that kind of crowd and started going in with the crowd that more drinks, and doing the two together was never a good night for me anyway.
When did you start to recognize that, oh, I'm drinking too much?
Probably when I was 22. And I was got on the back of a motorcycle with a guy I barely knew when we were up camping. And I rode all my life. I always was very responsible, rode bikes, rode quads, the sand dunes and things.
Okay.
I got on the back of this quad with this guy, and I blacked out and he blacked out, and he took us over a cliff, and somehow we survived. He got paralyzed. But I climbed myself way at the top, got help. My cousin came back, got help. It was a chaotic time. And I was like, oh, this is a problem. And so I stopped drinking for a very short period of time after that.
How short?
I would say probably probably about 3 months, like very short.
Okay.
Yeah.
And why'd you go back? Why'd you start again?
I was like, oh, I'm older now, you know, 3 months older
three
now,
months
like
older.
Silly. Yeah. Like I understand things differently now, and I'm going to be more responsible. I just felt like I had some more confidence in being responsible with it. And like, oh, I can handle this, you know, like it's okay. It's only going to be a couple, you know, and I'm going to be more responsible about it.
Did you ease back in at all, or did you start drinking pretty heavily when you started again?
In my mind, I think that I eased back in, but if looking back at the situation, because it's not like how often we drink or, you know, like that kind of thing, but I was always I couldn't have just one. I couldn't have just three. I'm going to put away and I'm going to compete with the guys that I'm hanging out with. And I'm going to like go hard, like every time.
Okay.
I know how that feels.
Yeah, I in that you say that compete with the guys, I know that, and I know it's dangerous. Like, the guys are doing it, we're counting our beers, right, when you're 20 years old or 22 years old.
Yep.
And I do recognize, like, a lot of my women who are friends could get caught up in that too, and they don't weigh what we do, and I've seen a lot of trouble that I attribute to kind of that type of drinking.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always hung out with guys. I was more comfortable. Like I was the girl, and you know, anytime girls came in, they had to be approved by Katrina. And like, I was the matriarch of the friend group. And I was like, oh, I gotta keep up. Like, I'm a tough girl. I can hang with these dudes, you know?
Okay. So when you started drinking again, did you realize that it was becoming problematic again?
Yeah, I realized it was becoming problematic, but I shoved that thought down as much as I could. Mm-hmm. And when I transitioned from relationship to a really quick relationship to my next relationship, which is my now husband, you know, I was like, oh, it's a fresh new relationship. This is fun and exciting. This is what we do. We go down to the bar and we see our bartender who knows our name, who knows our drink. As soon as we walk in the door, we party hard every weekend. And this is cool. This is fun. This is what you do at this age. Even though it was a problem, like waking up the next day and just feeling like total crap and mustering up what you could to maybe go out the next night even then, or get up the next morning and go to work, which became an issue. Like, I wasn't showing up to work and I knew that was an issue. I had people coming to find me, like, what's going on? But I think there was like other mental health stuff going on too that was, you know, underneath all of that drinking as well.
What kind of mental health stuff?
The depression, for sure. And I didn't find out till years later, like probably in 2017, when I had that rope around my neck, I was diagnosed bipolar depression, which isn't quite the same extreme bipolar things that we hear about. It's a little more subtle. And I've had anxiety my entire life. I've like had all of the things. I've been on medications. I've been on, you know, all of the things to overcome this like issue within myself, and alcohol was my outlet.
So did it take, when you said that it was after the incident with the rope around your neck, when you learned that you had bipolar depression, did you realize you had any sort of depression before that? It was this kind of a clarification of the type of depression, or were you kind of just didn't know?
I knew when I was young, about 19, when I first got diagnosed with depression and I got put on medication. And I'd been on medication throughout my entire life, off and on, up until a few years ago. But I always thought, like, it's not working anyway. Like, maybe I don't have depression. I never, like, kept it at the forefront of my mind. I was like, oh, this is just this thing. I take these pills. Sometimes I go off of them. Sometimes I use them to, like the suicidal ideation, you know, like I took a whole bunch of them at one time thinking maybe they're going to do something. They just made me feel like crap. And it wasn't at the forefront of my mind though, but I think it was always just there underlying within. And, you know, looking back, we don't know till we look back, you know, and if we're not in contact with somebody or talking to somebody who's actually there to support us and like identify these things, for me, I just didn't know. And I didn't have the parents, the parental people in my life to be like, hey, there might be a problem here. Let's go like work this out and figure this out. I was on my own.
And I do find myself when I dip into any level of depression. And I would normally characterize mine as relatively mild. At least I think it's relatively mild.
Yeah.
But I don't realize until I'm on my way up, until I'm out of it, that I was even in a depression.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to trick yourself into to not recognizing that. Maybe it's not tricking yourself. Maybe your brain just isn't capable of it during those times. But I totally get that.
No, I think it happens more often than we think. I forget every winter here in where I live that I get seasonal depression because of the weather, because of the clouds. And like, I forget that. And I was like, and I'm like, what is going on? Why am I so down? Why am I not leaving the house? And then usually it's an outside person like that starts talking about how that happens around here. I'm like, oh, that's right. Okay. So it's not just because I'm not trying hard enough. Like there's something actually going on.
Well, I was going to ask if there are, I mean, you said externally people will point out things, but do you have any kind of symptoms that kind of jump out at you? Like, and for example, what I'll say is I realize that when I'm depressed, when I start to realize that I was depressed, it's when I realize that I'm not listening to music and I'm not drinking coffee, like doing the little things. Are there specific things in your life that you find are kind of hints that you might be in a depression?
Yes. If I am on my like third day of just sitting on the couch and binge watching TV, that's one of them. If I like suddenly think, if I laugh and I realize that I haven't laughed in what seems like forever.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
If I'm not singing and dancing just at the whatever in my car, in my kitchen when I'm cleaning, like, oh, there's something going on. And if isolation is a big one too.
Okay. You're just, I don't know what to say because I've have been extremely isolated lately. I think producer Dan's probably heard me use the word more than once, like isolated is how I've been describing myself.
Yes.
So I need to think about some things. So any good TV to come out of that though, Katrina, you'd binge watch. What is Katrina like to watch on TV?
Oh God. I don't know if I want to answer this question.
Okay. It's trashy reality TV is my guess.
Well, it is. It's like Jersey Shore, catching up on Jersey Shore, catching up, rewatching the whole seasons of Supernatural.
Okay.
Big Bang Theory. That's what I love to put on when I recognize I need to laugh. Let's watch some Sheldon.
Nice.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
I have an array of different things that I just love to watch. It just depends the mood that I'm feeling. If I want comfort, it's going to be Big Bang Theory because I want that comfort, or Supernatural if I want to go dark comfort.
Okay.
Nice. I have recently discovered on the Roku channel Love After Lockup.
It's
a trashy show.
Yes. It
follows couples that met while one of them was in prison, and then they get out and their relationships inevitably all go off the rails.
Wow. Okay.
We'll put that in the show notes. So anyone who needs to find this, and Katrina, literally last week, I watched an episode. Well, I will say a part of an episode of Jersey Shore for the first time in my life. And that was also on the Roku channel. I did not make it through, but I changed from that to Flavor of Love. If everybody.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I did used to watch that one, but I also didn't make it through an episode of that. It was a little bit of good nostalgia though.
Oh my God. That makes me think of what was Bret Michaels. The one that he did, Rock of Love.
Oh, Rock of. Yep. Yep. Okay. Yep.
Yes.
It was all like the same very specific time period of VH1.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Back to you.
All right, we finally got on a topic that we're all very interested to talk about, and all of our listeners are on the edge of their seat, but now.
I don't know if anybody's on the edge of their seat. I think that anyone who wanted to see Rock of Love or Flavor of Love or Jersey Shore has seen them. So maybe we'll do a follow-up episode where we just talk trashy TV, but that's not what we're here for. We're here for Katrina to tell us a little bit more about her life. And what I'm curious about is you had this major accident that could have ended with the loss of your life or this other person's life.
Yeah.
And you get back to drinking. What does it take to make you realize, to make you stop? Like, after going through something like that and not stopping, you know, what happened that made you say, oh shit, this, I need to quit?
Yeah. So, you know, it wasn't anything major. I think it was just the buildup of all of the things. Okay. I used to drive around drunk with my kids and my twins. I drank when I was pregnant with them. And then I had them and I drank and drove with them in the car. You know, I just couldn't not drink. And there was a moment in which I used to hide the bottles from my husband, thinking he didn't know. And, you know, thinking I was being really sly. And that's just not the case. You know, he knew. And I had hidden a bottle of vodka down the front of my pants that he was trying to take from me because I had it hidden. I went to my secret spot to take a swig. He caught me. And so I hurried up and put it down the front of my pants because he was mad and he wanted to take it from me. And his mom actually came over and saw us wrestling around. And he got it from me. And she looked at me and she said, "Hey, Katrina, why don't we go get a burger?" And I was pissed and I didn't want to go, but I went. And she ended up taking me to my first Women's Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I was mad. I was not going to get out of the car. Like, you told me you were going to take a burger, going to get a burger. We were not going to get. And a woman came out and had a conversation with me. And I went in, I was plastered. And apparently I shared in that meeting and women were amazed by my share. And I say that's the best damn hamburger I've ever had. But I didn't get sober right away. I did, however, get a sponsor, and I did a few days later go down to a treatment center and have them evaluate me. And, I had, gotten checked in a few days later into a 28-day facility, program where I went away, left my 18-month-old twins at home, my husband at home to take care of things, and went in 28 days. And in there, I drank up until that last day. Like, my husband, it was the day before my second Mother's Day. And so he took us to the zoo. And I thought it was always funny that we went to the zoo before I went to the zoo. Like, literally, if you've ever been in treatment, it's like a zoo. And we did that. And then he drove me up and dropped me off in treatment. And it was in there that, you know, you can't drink, you get sober. But it was in there where I was like, the desire to drink left me quickly after a burning bush moment, is what they like to call it in the rooms, the 12-step rooms. And I got really pissed one day at my counselor, ran out of the room, went down, they had this little water creek, and I've always loved the outdoors. I've always loved the rivers, the water, went to this little creek. And I prayed for some reason, for like the first time in a long time. God, I don't know what it is. Just help me. I don't know. Just give me a sign, something, please. And I looked down and there was this little heart-shaped rock sitting there. Mm-hmm. And I picked it up and I held it and I was like, thank you. Like, that was my sign. And the desire to drink left. And I was on fire for life, on fire for working the program, on fire for like, I'm not doing this again. And I never had a desire to drink again.
Do you have the rock? Did you keep the rock?
I lost it. I kept it for several years, but now I pick up heart rocks when I find them.
I was going to say, though, fuck it. You lost. You don't need it anymore.
No.
Right?
Nope.
It's there for somebody else now.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's good, Dan. I like that. I like that.
I love that.
What I don't like, and what I'll say I don't like, and will tell anybody who knows me, if you ever want to convince me to do something and you tell me I'm getting a burger and I don't get that fucking burger, I am not going to listen to anything you have to say after that ever again.
So yeah.
You must have been open-minded to some extent. And that's the part that kind of gets me a little bit, is a lot of our guests and people I've talked to outside of this world, outside of this podcast, have said, like, if you're not ready, there's nothing anyone can say to you. And when I hear that you're wrestling over a bottle of alcohol, lied to, lied is a strong word, but
yes,
it's a lie. I mean, it's yeah. You were misled to get you into a meeting. Like, why do you think that was effective?
I think at that point, like deep within me, I knew that what was going on in my life was not okay, that I was not okay. And I was really sick and tired, but I did not know what else to do. Mm-hmm. And the craving and my attachment to it, like if I didn't drink for so long, like I would shake and I would see things run across the walls, like shadows across the walls. And even though I don't remember the meeting, I only remember what I remember because of what was shared with me for so many times over the years, is there was something that somebody said in that meeting, or maybe it was just the kind gesture of that woman coming out and being like, hey, we're here for you. Ooh, that's bringing tears as I think about it. Like there was something that did hit, and it was an intervention of some sort. God, spirit, whatever, highest power amongst those people, like that just hit the heart that was like, okay, I'm going to do something different. I ain't giving up drinking quite yet, but I know that I'm ready. And even when I went to treatment, I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. Because to me, I was always a lost cause. That's been one of my mentalities for a very long time, even in sobriety at times. It's like, I'm a lost cause. What's this going to do? And it was just somebody somewhere said something in there probably that gave me that little bit of hope.
And are you still working the 12 steps now? Do you go to meetings regularly?
I stopped going to meetings in 2021.
Okay.
But I still work the program throughout my life. I work with coaches. I work in other aspects. I'm always doing work on myself. But I still believe in the program 100%, especially for anybody who is, you know, in those first at least 4 or 5 years, you need that support. I was always of the mentality, like I would never stop going to programs. I'd never stop going to AA, but I had a coach who lovingly shared a different perspective with me that opened me up, that still allowed me like the love and grace and gratitude for what that program provided me. But it also saw where I was like, oh, this is kind of maybe keeping me stuck and there is something else available.
You said something that jumped out that, when you said you were hopeless, or I'm not sure exactly what word you used, but said that you're a lost cause, I think is one of the terms you used. Mm-hmm. And that I think probably made you a little skeptical that something like that would work, if I was hearing that right. But it makes me think of an episode we recorded with Bill early in our run, where Bill has been through the program and he does a lot of great work. He sponsors people, and he would ask people, are you ever going to drink again? And the people who said, no, I'm never going to drink again, were the people he's like, well, you don't need us then. They weren't ready to say, I need this fucking help so much, and I'm going to drink again. I can't do this, to know that they needed help and recognize that this is a lifetime thing that is going to be something that you're going to have to deal with. And it gets easier from what I understand.
Yeah.
But I find that I just see a parallel there with you not thinking you're too far gone for help or whatever that feeling was. And him, when he talks to people and he sees people who won't admit that they'll drink again, or they're not right. They're not ready. So I think that there was something there. If you knew you were so far gone, I don't know. I don't like saying it that way. So far gone, but it had its grips around you, the alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it did. And I love that what he shared. I never thought about it that way. And it also makes me think about, you know, people would share often, like, you know, when we talk about relapse or going back out, and people are like, I don't know what would happen if I go back out. And every time I was like, I know exactly what would happen if I go back out. I'm going to pick up a drink. I'm going to drink that drink. And then guess what? I'm going to do it again. And I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do it again, because I know deep within me, like I cannot, it is within me, whether it's whether you want to call it the allergy, the disease, all of the things, I know that alcohol is not okay for me and my body and my overall well-being. Like, I'm going to drink again. I'm going to get plastered, because I do it big. I'm not going to I'm not going to fool myself into thinking that I could, that I can just go and maybe have a couple and a few. And I think, you know, you're either an addict or you're not. There's no gray area there. And I know a lot of people talk about the gray area, like, you know, I'm sober curious, which I love that because I think that alcohol is a huge problem and we glorify it way too much in the world. But like, you either are or you aren't when it comes to this depth of the disease.
Thank you for saying that. I do think, and I've used the term on here a couple times, like the alcohol culture that we have.
Yeah.
And I participate in it from time to time, but I've always even judged myself on that participation and think that it is a pretty major problem in this country. And I think a lot of addicts have said that alcohol is like the most dangerous drug because of its accessibility and the fact that it can kill you, and people don't realize that. Or they might realize it, but just not take it as seriously because everybody drinks.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you quit drinking, and you mentioned that there was a period of time before you ended up, like years between the end of drinking before you ended up with the rope around your neck. And I'm just kind of curious about those years. Was there a lot of depression involved in those intervening years?
There was some depression here and there, but I always maintained, for the first 5 years, where I would go to meetings. I had my meetings where I served, was in a role of service, and I had my home group, and I had people that I enjoyed seeing at particular meetings. And so you would find me in the first 2 years at a meeting as many days as I could go. I had, you know, I still had kids at home I needed to take care of. And so, but as many days as I could go, sometimes the kids went with me. And then it backed off to probably 2-3 meetings a week because I had my favorites and my people were there and I wanted to show up and be there. And it was incredible. And, you know, in there, life things were happening. I think depression set in. I think, you know, I started to do more work on myself through other programs, personal development programs, and, you know, just life happening, trying to find my way professionally and career wise. And, you know, it's the longing that I've had for a long time that I think brought me to my knees there, with that rope, is like, I know there's something more for me, but I don't know what it is. And I think it's like the core of like why I turned to alcohol as well. But it was really good for a long time. I had friendships. We did sober activities. We went, you know, on the camp trips. We hung out. I had a couple different groups that I hung out with. We did Black Friday shopping together. We did, you know, girls' nights together. We did book studies together. And it was great for a long time.
Okay.
I don't think we talked much about your husband. I mean, he helped with the intervention. Does he drink? Is he sober? What's his story?
Yeah, he is not an alcoholic. He drinks on occasion, very rarely. He was very respectful and supportive. Well, he was very respectful and supportive in the aspect of like, there was no alcohol in the home up until like a year ago. Mm-hmm. And even then it's not regularly kept in the home. He drinks occasionally when we're in settings, social settings. He ended up going through his own story and program through the sister program of AA, which is Al-Anon, because he had some stuff to work through. And but yeah, he's always been very supportive. Not really a drinker. He can put him back too. Like, you know, when we do go out, there are times we've got some interesting stories, and but it's not a problem like it was for me.
God, I was going to make a joke about being the sober one with the drunk person. I can imagine that it gets occasionally the drunk people are annoying.
Yes. I'll tell you really quick. Like there was a time we went to a friend's party and he drank more than he usually does. And we were driving home, and I don't know, I must have been speeding, but we got pulled over, and Thank God I was shaking so bad because you could smell the alcohol from my husband who had been puking before we left.
Oh.
And this is why they pulled over, because I was on the side of the road because he had to throw up again.
Oh no.
And they wanted to check on us and he like smelled the alcohol and he was asking like, have you been drinking? No, officer, I've been sober for 3 years. I swear to God. And I was like, don't do that to me ever again.
Right. Oh, shit. Well, I'm glad that you were sober. It sounds like the best position to be in. You can say, I'm a fucking designated driver right now, officer. Yeah. I'm doing what you guys tell me to do. So get the hell out of here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right. That's awesome. And I guess I think we're kind of getting to that point where it's time to turn to what's going on in your life now, Katrina. This is about thriving after trauma. So how are you thriving today?
My family is beautiful. I've had another kid since my twins. They're 10 years apart. So I have 15-year-old twins and my 5-year-old son. And they are like, I do this on the days that I always said in the beginning, like on the days I couldn't do it for myself, I did it for them. Mm-hmm. And I look at them now and I just think about the life that they are living is so different than the life that I got to live with or without the alcohol being involved. Just the difference of parenting, love, showing up for them. And they are like truly my joy and my pain and the you know what at times. But I love them and I live in a beautiful home with my husband. You know, my husband works. I have the privilege of staying home and pursuing my dream of being a coach who helps other women and other people. And I have my own podcast. And like, I am really like, I've written a workbook and printed a workbook. I know another book is within me. And like, I just get to bring people together and help them see their worth, no matter what they're going through. Cause it like seeing that light turn back on in somebody's eyes is the best fucking thing in the world.
I love that.
I like that. That
is a great quote. I'm going to remember that one. And I've been there. I've been the one to feel it come back on in my eyes, you know, and it's a pretty amazing feeling. You said a lot that I want to touch on because you're doing the coaching and the podcast, but I do also want to say that like the parenting part and Terrible Rita is my mom, biggest fan we've got.
Hey, Terrible Rita.
So this isn't a criticism about the way I was raised. This is just looking at all of the opportunity that kids have today, both because things have been more, or, you know, it's modern times, I guess, but also because I lived in a very rural area where we didn't have opportunities to see what my nieces and nephews and to see Dan and with his daughter and my other friends with their kids and all of the fucking things that they can do to give them these amazing lives. It's such a cool thing to me. I don't have kids. I like to give them back. So I babysit a lot, but it's just so fucking cool to me to see the lives that children lived that I never had the opportunity to. And again, mom, Terrible Rita, no bitterness, just saying things have changed.
I get that. I mean, things got healed with my dad and I. They're not the best. They're not the way I would have loved to see our relationship, but they're better. I get braver and braver the more I talk to him to tell him how I'm actually doing and feeling and when he needs to quit complaining so much, you know. And I love him so much, and he came back into my life the same time my husband and I met, and it's been a roller coaster, but that's life. And things are not great between my mom and I. I have to keep her at a distance, but I have gratitude for her today and love. I know she does not see that or receive that, but I do. I love her and appreciate because she has taught me just as much, you know. Mm-hmm. and it's just, it's beautiful.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned a podcast. What's your podcast called?
Yes, it is Back to the Just As We Are podcast.
All right.
Yes.
And that's available everywhere?
It's available wherever you listen to podcasts. Yep.
All right. I always ask that. I just want to give someone the chance to say available everywhere. It feels like such a podcasty thing to say. Wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes.
All right. Awesome. And your coaching, if someone's interested in talking to you, where would they find you?
I hang out a lot over on Instagram. So you can find me at Katrina A. Lully over there. You can also go to my website and get your free guided meditation, katrinalully.co. But mostly Instagram.
All right, cool. And I guess my final question is there anything that you've learned on this journey, the journey to sobriety through depression? Is there one piece of advice that you'd want to give our listeners from something you've learned?
It's not new probably to most people, but it's a reminder, because I need the reminder all the time, not to take yourself so damn seriously or this life so damn seriously. If you are, go find something to laugh. Pull up a Big Bang Theory episode. Pull up something to make yourself laugh. Go outside and walk. Stop taking it so seriously, because I promise you, most of that is in your head.
All right. Or listen to Positively Terrible, because we are very serious, but we also like to laugh.
So fucking serious.
So fucking serious. My favorite quote from our last episode that was released was Dan saying, "How often do you eat gas station pizza?" Listening to that at half speed, I accidentally put that at half speed. I have listened to it 30 times this week and think it's the funniest thing ever.
Oh man, I'm gonna have to go do that.
Well, Katrina, what area of the country do you live in?
I'm in Washington State.
Okay, so I will be in Washington State at the end of this month. Very quick trip. I'm going to see a Mariners game. I'm also going to Portland for a day to see a concert and then visiting a friend. So
nice, awesome.
I'll be in Tacoma and Seattle and Portland over 3 days. So nice. A lot of moving around. But I was going to say, if you're in the Midwest, Casey's Pizza, maybe we should shout that out. Give them free advertising on just about every episode, because Dan and I are big fans. But
big fans.
Katrina, thank you so much for being on. This has been really great. I appreciate you being so open with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for the laughter and all of the conversation. I know it's a lot, but it was so much fun.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. And we're grateful that you were able to come on. Humbled. There's so many words, and I never have enough of them that I want to say. But it's been great. And Katrina and listeners, you can follow us at Positively Terrible on Instagram and on Facebook. And you can email us at podcast@positivelyterrible.com if you want to be on the show. And as always, this has been absolutely, positively terrible. I met you back at Tanaka's Fest. I confess I was nervous and stressed, because I thought you were the best.
Positively Terrible is a part of the Terrible Podcast Network.